Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode takes a look at the future of cyber warfare and the ways in which the U.S. might protect its institutions and its citizens from such attacks. In this hour, we'll hear from Nicole Perlroth. She's a reporter at the New York Times. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience, and this broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. And now to our moderator, Kim Zetter, author of Countdown to Zero Day.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us this evening. It's my pleasure to introduce Nicole Perlroth, who's a cybersecurity reporter for the New York Times. Nicole also has a book coming out next March on cybersecurity called This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends. And she's a guest lecturer at Stanford Graduate School of Business. So I want to start tonight's conversation, and obviously the timing for this conversation is very apropos to everything that's going on in the news right now, particularly the Equifax breaches. But I want to start, first of all, just to getting a little bit of information about your background, Nicole. So you started with Forbes covering venture capital and business, and then you switched in 2011 to cybersecurity. So tell us a bit about how you got into journalism and why you made that switch in 2011 to cybersecurity.
My story is a little bit funny. I know we have some high school students here today, but I never worked for a school paper. I never studied journalism in college. I really didn't know what I wanted to do with my life after college, and I took a series of increasingly more boring corporate jobs and really sort of just missed the intellectual component that I'd had in college. So I took a nighttime class in continuing studies at NYU, and the professor for that class was a guy named John Crudell, who was a business columnist at the New York Post. And he said, you know, you're a pretty good writer, and I think you should try and give this journalism thing a try, and maybe you should try freelancing, and actually I have a bone I can throw you, you know. And I think that week there had been a rat in Taco Bell fiasco where they'd found rats doing like cartwheels in the back of some Taco Bell KFC or something. And he said, why don't you go out and go through the Department of Health's records and find out what other restaurants in New York have cockroaches and health problems. So I spent like a week of my free time looking through these disgusting Department of Health records. And I ended up finding this restaurant that was really nice that I had just eaten at that had a horrible health record. And so I called them and I said, you know, I've been looking at your health record and it's horrible. It says you have cockroaches and rats and this is the worst health record I've seen all week, but I just ate there, so I know you're a good restaurant. And they said, oh my God, you know, the health inspector came in, he was inspecting the restaurant, and he just actually ended up just getting drunk at the bar, passing out. And then to explain to a supervisor why it took him so long, he wrote us, you know, a failed report, and we actually have footage of the whole thing. So I went back to the guy at the New York Post and I said, you know, I didn't do the assignment you gave me, but I do have this footage of this health inspector passed out drunk at this bar and failing this restaurant. And they ended up putting it on the front page of the New York Post that Sunday, and it said, like, rat nap.
It's a New York Post story.
Yeah, total New York Post headline, Inspector Snoozo. And, you know, I was just hooked. So I went to journalism school, and I went to Stanford. They have a small journalism program, and I used the opportunity to take some classes at some of the different schools. And I took some classes at the GSB, and one of them was in business ethics, and I just thought it was fascinating. You know, people who are young, who are going into journalism, don't really think of business journalism as something that's very sexy or interesting. Most of the people in my program wanted to go in to cover culture or art or sports. But I found some of the ethics around some of these business decisions fascinating, and I never wanted to be the reporter that goes and chases ambulances or knocks on someone's door after they've lost a child. So business journalism really seemed like a interesting path to try to go down. And my first job was at Forbes as a criminally paid intern. And I just sort of worked my way up and ended up getting a full-time gig covering venture capital and startups out here in Silicon Valley. And that was just great timing because at the time, Facebook hadn't gone public yet. Venture capital was really coming back from the dead in some ways after the dot-com bust. And these companies and startups were getting tons of funding, and it was really interesting. And I would have covered that for as long as they would have let me. But one day I got a call from the New York Times, and they said, "We're looking at you for a job." And I said, "What? You know, what are you talking about?" They're like, "Well, we're looking at you for this job, but we're not sure you're going to want it." And I said, "Well, how bad could it be?" And they said, "It's cybersecurity." And I was thinking, like, you want to take me off this gravy train to go cover cybersecurity? But I ended up interviewing for the job, and I got the job. And the whole time I'm thinking, maybe if I'm really good at covering cybersecurity, they'll let me go back to covering venture capital and startups. But that was 6 years ago, and things have just gone absolutely crazy since then. And, you know, Kim knows because she covers the same beat I do. But it's like every year it's just an even more scary disaster is happening. And, you know, in the beginning it was Chinese cyber espionage, and then it was North Korea hacking Sony over a James Franco movie. And then it was the Snowden documents, and now it's, you know, who knows where it's going to go.
So I'm wondering about how you've experienced the different beats, because cybersecurity has a very vocal community, and they're very intelligent but also very opinionated, and they're not shy about letting you know, expressing their displeasure when you've either gotten something wrong or they think that you've gotten something wrong. So was that the same kind of experience that you had covering venture capital and business, or has this been a different experience, just how critical this community can be and how focused they are on details, particularly technical details, and has that been difficult for you?
It has been very difficult. It's a, you know, like you said, it's a hypercritical community. If you get something wrong, you're not going to get away with it. You know, you're going to hear from 1,000 people on Twitter the next day. You know, covering venture capital was interesting. It's a really self-promotional business. So I would get a lot of calls from venture capitalists promoting themselves, touting their deals, telling me why I should write about them. And then I'd have to go run that by, you know, three other people, and they would tell me that's BS. That person's actually not that involved in that deal, and they're not worth that much. And, you know, so that was interesting because it was sort of sorting through the marketing of it all. And some of that is true in cybersecurity. There's a lot of security firms out there who are calling out vulnerabilities in systems that might not be a big deal, but they're just dying for you to write about them so that they can get more funding or sell more useless defense mechanism. So that part has translated well. The part that has been really hard has been this hyper-technical community. I think my challenge has been translating a lot of what happens for the layperson. And sometimes in a round of edits or three edits, that gets very dumbed down to a point where this highly technical, critical community is not quite happy with the way it turned out. But if I did it their way, then, you know, my parents would, not understand it. But it's definitely, you know, I always say the hardest part of the story these days is the day after it publishes. You know, it's right. Just the criticisms are, you know, there's no escaping it.
Right. So we've seen, as you discussed, sort of the change of in cybersecurity, the kinds of things that we're covering. For a long time, what we were looking at, what was happening in the cybersecurity realm was really criminal activity, hacking of banks and credit card numbers. And then we had espionage, nation-state espionage, economic espionage. And now we're looking at really hacking of critical infrastructure, a lot of more nation-state attacks, and even attacks that could eventually lead to loss of life. So things have really escalated in terms of the risks and the consequences. So let's talk a bit about how we got here. I mean, why are we so bad at cybersecurity? And there seem to be all of these companies that are offering solutions. Is it all snake oil? Does anyone have a solution for any of this? How did we get here?
It's a long answer, as you know, but it's, you know, 40 years ago, people at the Pentagon designed the internet with maybe 50 giant mainframe computers at MIT, at UCLA, at defense contractors around the country. And they never thought it was going to end up being something that we basically depend on for our productivity and personal lives the way it is now. And we have just added and added and added as much as we can onto this thing. And our answer to security has just been, let's band-aid this, let's cross our fingers and hope this never happens. And it just is not sustainable. So 6 years ago, when I started on this beat, people were warning about the type of critical infrastructure attacks that we're starting to see now. But back then, it was tricky about how to report on it because some of these things hadn't happened. And yes, they were possible, but they hadn't happened yet. And you didn't really want to scare the hell out of people. Now they're happening. And, you know, just in the last couple of months, we've seen nation state hackers probing nuclear facilities in the U.S. They haven't gotten very far, but they're actively looking at nuclear facilities. We've seen Russian hackers really find this sweet spot in the United States between combination of partisanship, between putting all our information into emails and online, between, you know, the just red tape around some of our federal agencies in terms of how well they're equipped to deal with some of these disinformation campaigns that we saw ahead of the 2016 election. So we're at a place now where these decisions we've made over the last 40 years are finally catching up to us. And as far as solutions, there aren't very many plausible solutions out there. There's what security companies are offering, which on, you know, is a baseline for security. You know, plug in your antivirus solution, maybe add this intrusion detection mechanism, do basic software updates and patching. But some of the most sophisticated threats we see out there have been able to evade all of the security industry's solutions. You know, there's been talk of maybe coming up with some sort of Geneva Convention for cybersecurity, where we talk about some of the norms that are acceptable and are not acceptable.
Such as keeping systems off limits.
Yeah, keeping certain systems off limits. And even there, I don't know if those will work. You know, what's interesting is that in the United States, the people who are doing some of the most sophisticated hacks are at the NSA or they're at Cyber Command. In Russia, cyber criminals are freelancing for the government. In China, similarly, people are working for both defense contractors or universities to exploit intellectual property theft, or they're PLA hackers who do freelance hacking on the side. So, you know, it's harder to come up with an international norms of behavior when you're dealing with these sort of transnational actors. I feel like I'm constantly pointing out problems and I'm never writing about some of the solutions. I think that's part of the work that the press needs to do better, and I include myself in that group. The best thing that's happened over the last 6 years has just been general awareness around some of these issues. These aren't considered just part of the technical realm or part of something that these people over there talk about. We all have to talk about them now. And, you know, this Equifax breach, you know, half the country's personal information now is in some hacker's hands and we don't even know who they are. And we don't know why this could have happened. And we don't know what the government's planning on doing about it. And what can you do about it as a consumer? I mean, it really is sort of the perfect storm.
So there's been a lot of finger pointing at software companies, and the idea that, you know, we wouldn't have a lot of these problems if software wasn't so vulnerable. And so I'm wondering if we're at a point now where there needs to be some kind of liability for poorly secured software. And the reason that I'm saying that is, I mean, obviously software has a lot of lines of code and it's hard to get everything right. But what we're seeing, particularly in the Internet of Things, and by that I mean anything that's the critical devices that are connected to the Internet, I'm not talking about refrigerators and toasters, but medical devices, cars, critical infrastructure, election systems. We're seeing with the Internet of Things a lot of basic problems that have existed for two decades, that we know that there are problems in the way that systems are designed, lack of encryption, lack of authentication, things like that. And yet we still see companies putting out these products without basic security in them. So I'm wondering if there needs to be some kind of regulation that requires sort of base level security. And I'll just point out to like the FDA, which oversees medical devices, last year for the first time started demanding some kind of basic security among medical device makers. So is that something that we should be looking at going after the manufacturers?
Yes, is the short answer. It's been a struggle, though. So for the last few years, the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees critical the cybersecurity for critical infrastructure in the country, has tried to come up with and has been pushing for sort of a baseline of good security practices that the companies that control electrical utilities or gas pipelines or solar energy companies or election systems should follow. But none of them have really had, and I think President Obama eventually signed an executive order setting up some threat sharing combined with some bar of good practices for some of these critical infrastructure companies. But they weren't mandatory. They were all voluntary. And I don't know if it's going to work. There was a lot of lobbying against even just regulations stating have two-factor authentication be a standard practice for employees at an oil facility. Mm-hmm. You know, people were pushing back against these things. So I do think there needs to be a better standard. You know, I think right now there's no liability for breaches beyond class action suits. I think usually what you see is you see a lot of news after a breach, and then you look at the stock 2 weeks later and it hasn't changed. I think that there should be some kind of malpractice for security vendors when their product doesn't catch something. I think that we've allowed the security to sell more and more mousetraps for the last couple of decades, and yet we see threats continue to proliferate, and we see people and actors get past some of these defenses. But at the baseline, I think what you just, the first question you asked about liability for coders, you know, I don't know if there should be liability for coders, but I have seen some of the most interesting solutions out there have been market-based. So Peter Zatko's idea for a consumer reports for software, where when you go out to buy a refrigerator or a washing machine, you see a big consumer report sticker on there that tells you, you know, what people who know about these things think of the product. Well, we don't have anything like that for any of the apps or services that we entrust with some of our most personal information, with our medical histories. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where we need to start heading, is we need to come up with some sort of system where you know whether the software you're using has been patched, you know whether it's had a basic audit. Otherwise, why are we entrusting your most personal information to some of these companies?
And what about breaches? I mean, so if we're looking at the one end of the market in terms of the creators of software, the other end of the market of the people who are holding our data, the Equifax obviously is just one of a long string of companies and organizations who have lost really sensitive customer and non-customer data. People aren't customers of Equifax. There was a suggestion by a former National Security Council member last week who had said that he thought that there should be some kind of mandatory fine for companies and organizations that lose information like this, maybe $1,000 per person, and that would incentivize them to increase their security. What do you make of that?
I think it's a very interesting idea. I think it is a little bit blaming the victim. I mean, the problem right now is that companies don't just have to defend against cyber criminals anymore that find a basic hole in your software and get in and steal all of your information. They have to defend against the Russian intelligence agencies. They have to defend against the Chinese military, and in some cases, our own NSA. So, you know, Yahoo, for example, had a huge breach, and two of them actually. And in both cases, I think something like half a billion users' information was compromised. So I don't know. I haven't looked at Yahoo's finances in a while, but that would be a pretty big penalty if they were going to take that suggestion up.
But quite often the techniques are very basic.
Yes.
We see over and over again, you mentioned the pushback against two-factor authentication.
Yes.
When we look into sort of behind the scenes of how these breaches occur, quite often it's through a phishing attack, something basic, and...
Right. They didn't run their software updates.
Right.
Or they were using password as their password, or they weren't... Right. When I see breaches like that, and you and I have covered them over and over and over again, they're infuriating at this point. So I agree. I mean, there should be some kind of baseline where if you're breached and you've sacrificed a billion customers' most personal information, like your social security number or your fingerprints in the case of the OPM breach. There should be some kind of penalty for that if you're completely negligent. If you're up against a nation state hacker like Russia's GRU, and they're using a vulnerability that no one knew about and no one even had an opportunity to patch, that might be a different situation. The trouble is getting any kind of legislation that makes that kind of nuanced differentiation through Congress when Congress doesn't know what two-factor authentication is a pretty big...
And are proud that they don't use email.
Yeah. Right, and are proud that they don't use email is a pretty big ask.
Let's talk a bit about that. You mentioned, you know, when you're up against a nation state that's using a vulnerability no one knows about, which is we call a zero-day vulnerability, a zero-day exploit. Let's talk a bit about WannaCry, the major ransomware attack that struck the National Health Service in the UK, but also elsewhere. That used, in order to spread the ransomware, it used a zero-day exploit known as Eternal Blue that is believed to have been created and held by the NSA and their offensive teams to use for hacking NSA targets. It was stolen by a group that we now know as the Shadow Brokers. And when the NSA learned that it had been stolen, notified Microsoft in January, and Microsoft began to develop a patch, released a patch for this vulnerability, but didn't release it to everyone. If you used an old version of Windows, such as Windows XP, you didn't get the patch unless you were subscribed to a special service to Microsoft. And then whoever is behind WannaCry, some say North Korea, used this Eternal Blue exploit to spread ransomware. So in a case like this, who do we blame? Who bears the most responsibility? Is it the NSA for withholding this exploit instead of telling Microsoft years ago when they developed it that this vulnerability existed? Is it the NHS for not using a more recent version of software or not purchasing the special subscription? Who's really to blame here?
That was a really interesting attack because everyone was to blame. You know, people wanted to blame Microsoft for not rolling out the patch to everyone, but can we ask a company to continue to be responsible for the security of a product that they've stopped selling and stopped putting out there? Maybe. You know, maybe we're willing to do that because Microsoft is such a big company and we rely on their software for so many things. Is the NSA to blame? I don't know. You know, I think that the NSA, it's a very interesting program that the United States started, which is hoarding exploits and widely used software and not telling the company whose software had a vulnerability in it about it so that they can use it to potentially spy on our adversaries or terrorists. And, you know, you could look at that and say, well, we're all using that software, so why are you leaving the rest of us vulnerable? Or you could probably say, well, if the NSA wasn't doing this, then they might be incompetent, you know? And so it's an interesting question. And in this case, the patch was available, but it was a little nuanced. It wasn't made available to everyone. And the companies that it turned out were using old Microsoft software and not updating their systems were companies that I actually was quite surprised by. It was FedEx. It was Rosneft, Russia's biggest state-owned energy company. It was the, as you mentioned, the British health system. And there were real repercussions for this. I mean, in England, people's surgeries were being stopped. You know, people were not able to check into hospitals. Emergency rooms were turning people away. So it was the first attack that we've covered where there was a real potential for a loss of life. And it was this perfect storm of a government hoarding vulnerabilities in these systems, a company not making sure that the patch to this poll was released to everyone who could possibly use it, and then the customers for not keeping their systems patched and using old software. So it's a great case study for the problems that we have out there and the potential impact. And as far as who's to blame, you know, it reminds me of like the subprime mortgage crisis. You know, is it like the people who wanted to get a cheap loan for their house or the brokers or the lenders or the rating agencies who were looking somewhere else? And And ultimately, like, we were the ones who paid for the thing with the bailout. So, you know, I feel the same way about this. I think ultimately we're all going to have to pay the price for these sort of black holes in how we handle security, but there's enough blame to go all around. Mm.
That's a good segue to your book, I think, because your book is focused on the zero-day market, which sells not just these zero-day vulnerabilities and exploits to government and intelligence agencies, but also in the black market to underground criminals. Let's talk first of all about your title, the title of the book. Where did you come up with that? Why is...
Well, okay, so the book's called This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends. And it gets back to something I said earlier, which is that 6 years ago when I started off in this job at the New York Times, I reached out to security researchers, I reached out to security companies, and they just scared the hell out of me. You know, they basically were making me feel like someone was spying on me through my web camera and possibly at my apartment through my thermometer. And that if I, you know, didn't do this, this, and this, that, you know, suddenly my computer was going to explode one day through some physical hack. You know, there's a lot of what they call in the industry FUD, which stands for fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And that's what a lot of these security companies count on to sell their products. So the book starts there. That, you know, in the beginning, I thought this was a lot of snake oil, and that a lot of these scenarios that they were laying out didn't feel quite like real world tangible threats. But over the last 6 years, it turns out that actually we've seen many of them play out. Like the one we just mentioned with the WannaCry attacks, where North Korea used leaked NSA tools to hack hospitals in Britain, and suddenly people are dying. I mean, it's all happening right now. That was the idea for the book. The concept for the book was a little different, which was I was asked to come to New York. I wasn't told what I was being called to New York for, but usually I was working from San Francisco. And I was called to New York, and I was asked to put my devices in a box and basically enter a secure undisclosed location at the New York Times. And it turned out we had been given access to some of the Edward Snowden documents, that they had been leaked to The Guardian. And when the GCHQ, which is the NSA's equivalent in England, came knocking on their door, they sent a hard drive to the New York Times as sort of an insurance policy.
Because they were eventually ordered to destroy
Right. Yes. Yeah, so you learned a lot about the freedom of the press in England is actually substantially less than what we have here in the United States.
So we also learned that GCHQ thinks that you can actually destroy digital documents by destroying a hard drive.
Right. Exactly. Which is false.
not how it works.
So I get into this room at the New York Times, and for about 2 months, my assignment was to figure out how far the NSA had gone in cracking or circumventing encryption. And in the process of that project, I saw many references to our security partners who are giving us, you know, trading exploits, or our commercial partners or hackers who are selling us ways into. And then there were just these Excel sheets of all the different technologies that the NSA and GCHQ had inroads into for spying. And not answered in the documents was where these came from. Some of them came from the NSA's own hackers, but littered through the documents were these references to sort of private market partners. And I left that room wondering whether these were hackers that were selling these exploits to the government. And that set me off on just a long reporting project that I thought actually was much better suited for a book about the private market for these vulnerabilities and all the technology that we use. So that's what I've been doing for the last couple of years in my spare time. And what I found was, you know, there is a market where the government will, usually through brokers, will pay hackers substantial money, sometimes, you know, certainly six figures, but increasingly more than that.
We've seen an advertisement of up to $1 million for one Apple iOS vulnerability.
One vulnerability and your iPhone software now sells for $1 million. So I started tracking this market, and I was just infatuated with this idea that the government was using taxpayer dollars to pay hackers up to $1 million for a hole in software that they could use to spy on everyone. But in the meantime, they weren't telling Apple about it, because if they tell Apple about it, Apple patches the hole. Whereas if they don't tell Apple about it, then they can use it to spy on terrorists or criminals or really whoever they want. Problem is, you can't guarantee that you're the only one that knows about this hole. And usually, increasingly, if you know about a hole in a widely used software, chances are someone else knows about it too. And in the process of sort of hoarding these vulnerabilities, they leave open the possibility that our adversaries or cyber criminals might use the vulnerability back on our own population. So I was just infatuated with this whole concept. It just sounded so bizarre. I could not believe it was true. And in the course of my reporting, I found out it is true. There's a very healthy market for these vulnerabilities, and it was started here in the United States, but it's actually spread far beyond the United States to places like Argentina, who are not necessarily allies of the United States. Hackers there don't necessarily have the same Western views as the United States.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Nicole Perlroth. She's a reporter at the New York Times. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. The World Affairs Council is a nonprofit membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our moderator, Kim Zetter.
Well, we should point out that it's not just hackers who are selling. There is this entire military-industrial complex that now creates and sells exploits and vulnerabilities for the government.
Right.
Our defense contractors.
Right.
Raytheon.
Yep. Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, they all participate in this market. They're all searching for zero-day vulnerabilities. They're buying them from hackers. It's not like it's just hackers meeting up with the NSA. It's a lot of times it's Lockheed Martin developing cyber weapons that rely on these vulnerabilities to work. So there's a whole industry out there, and no one really acknowledges it. No one really talks about it. Up until recently, we didn't know that the government has never admitted that this market exists, and we didn't really know what the prices were in this market. And actually, the first instance of the government admitting that it paid hackers was last year when the FBI first tried to force Apple in court to turn over a backdoor into the iPhone so it could get into the iPhone of one of the San Bernardino gunmen. And when Apple refused, the FBI ultimately said, never mind, actually, we don't need your help. We actually found some other people.
Forget this court case.
Right, forget this court case. We paid these people. And they said, you know, James Comey sort of gave a range, and basically people did the math, and he said, we paid hackers over $1 million to get a hole into his phone, and we don't need your help anymore. And that was just unbelievable. That was the first time that the government has really admitted that it does this. So that's what my book is about.
Well, so let's ask that
long
question.
Long story
then.
Short.
I mean, is there any, well, first of all, did you uncover any real surprises that, I mean, you mentioned that you were intrigued by this and you realized how extensive it was. Was there something that really surprised you in terms of looking at?
That it's been going on a lot longer than I think has been acknowledged or even reported on. It's been going on for decades. And it's gotten to a point where, you know, now the U.S. government actually has a process in place where at the White House cybersecurity coordinator now has to pull in representatives from a lot of major agencies. I mean, when you think about the vulnerabilities in the software that's being hoarded, and the fact that airplanes now rely on some of the software, you know, transportation systems, medical devices, the healthcare system, it's not just your iPhone anymore. These are critical infrastructure that are all using some of the same Windows software that you use just at your desktop. So now there is a process in place at the White House where they sit around a table and they argue about whether to turn over these vulnerabilities to the companies whose software is riddled with these holes. And what I learned is that some of those fights are really vicious. You know, there's a lot of blood left on the table in some of those debates.
Well, we should point out, though, that until 2014, I think it was 2014, the NSA was the sole arbiter of whether or not it was going to stockpile a zero day, and no one else was overseeing this process.
Right.
So it's pretty new.
It is new, and it's new that they've even admitted that they have a process, and they have to do so in part because some of the impacts from these breaches are getting so big. But so that was one. I mean, another was just how far the market has spread. Like I said, like at the end of the book, I go down to Argentina and I sit down with some of the hackers who are selling these exploits to governments. And I remember asking a really dumb question of one of them, which was, so do you only sell your vulnerabilities to, quote unquote, you know, good Western governments? Like, you're not selling these to China or Iran, right? And the hacker said, well, you know, Nicole, last time I checked, the country that bombed another country into oblivion wasn't China or Iran. So you really need to shift your worldview. And they basically said, I'll sell to whoever offers me the most money. And that was just a big wake-up call that this has, you know, it started in the U.S. 2 decades ago, but it's spread so far. And, you know, we're really leaving it to people's moral compasses to decide whether or not or who to sell to.
Well, I mean, let's examine that question for a second in terms of, I mean, the government, the U.S. government obviously needs zero-day vulnerabilities and exploits to track terrorist groups, suspected terrorists, and they use them for criminal groups as well. How do we balance that need, that legitimate need, to retain digital weapons like this against the need to be securing government, critical infrastructure systems, et cetera?
I asked Michael Hayden this question, and Michael Hayden was a former head of the NSA and CIA, and I thought he would have a really intelligent response. And he just said, Nicole, there are some problems have no easy solutions. You know, and I think that's really true. I think, like I said earlier, if the U.S. government wasn't doing this and there was some major attack, and people had been trading information via their iPhones, we would call the government incompetent. On the other hand, you know, we just saw this attack Kim mentioned, where some of those vulnerabilities that the NSA was hoarding were used to attack hospitals and hold hospitals hostage. I think actually the U.S. process is actually pretty much as good and thorough as it gets. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is actually another country out there that has a process where they're gathering representatives from different government agencies and debating what the merits are of holding on to a vulnerability versus disclosing them. The process is that we really started this market and we opened Pandora's box, and now it's in places where they're never going to sit down around a table and decide whether it's good or bad that they're hoarding a vulnerability that could affect, you know, our transportation system. So, you know, we've really lost control of the market, and it's a great first step that we have these internal debates at the White House, but, you know, we really don't know what's being said, or we don't know what vulnerabilities the government's hoarding until they get out, which is the case with the latest attack. Someone called the shadow brokers, we still don't know who, is leaking the NSA's trove of these vulnerabilities, and we still don't know who they are. So at the very least, we need to do a better job securing our own stockpile of vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm.
So we've been gathering some of your audience questions here, and I'm just going to pose one of these. In the 2016 Apple San Bernardino case, do you think the government should impose, as an example, do you think the government should impose on tech companies to assist investigations by creating software that weakens security settings, and why? I mean, so should Apple have increased the security of that system to the extent that it could no longer assist? Do tech companies have an obligation for national security reasons, for safety reasons?
It's an interesting question. It's a really good question, and that's another one where there are no easy answers. But I think in that case, I sided more on the side of the security researchers who said you can't just create a weakened security system for the U.S. government, because iPhones aren't just used in the United States anymore. In fact, there's more market share for Apple's products abroad. So the first thing that would happen if Apple had agreed to create that hole for the U.S. government is China would have also requested a backdoor to the iPhone, and Russia would request a backdoor to the iPhone, and it would never end. And a lot of the anecdotes that we heard in our reporting for what happened internally at Apple is that, you know, ever since the Snowden documents came out, they've had foreign governments that don't have the best human rights track record knocking down their door every day asking, well, how do I get one of those? You know, how do I get my own back door into your products? And that's probably the first thing that would happen. So do I think Apple should have weakened its security? No. I just think the U.S. government has to find really good hackers
step
out there
exactly.
willing
well,
to
showed.
Sell
with the
them
San
a vulnerability.
Bernardino, they insisted to the court that there was no other way of getting into that phone
right.
except with Apple's help. And then
right.
there was another way.
Right. And, you know, it's about to get harder. I just was reading a report today that the next iPhone might have facial recognition technology to unlock your phone. So, you know, there's probably a thousand ways hackers will find to get around that. But, you know, government might argue that makes it even harder to get into criminals and terrorist phones. So.
Mm-hmm. HBO said that it was working with law enforcement and outside cybersecurity firms. What role does the government and private cybersecurity firms have in ensuring a company's, this is about privacy. Should the government have more responsibility in dealing with cyber attacks? So I guess this is sort of was an interesting question that came up in the Sony hack, where President Obama seemed to indicate that one of the reasons that they were publicly coming out and pointing the finger at North Korea was they wanted companies to know that the government had their back. But there was also a question of if the government had the ability to attribute to North Korea, why didn't they see it happening beforehand and notifying? So I guess the question is, like, what is the responsibility of the government in terms of securing systems, private systems or critical infrastructure? Most of our critical infrastructure is owned privately. What should be the role and the responsibility of the government in terms of notifying if they see something happening? Or,
well, it's interesting because people assume that the government is going to save you from an attack from North Korea. Mm-hmm. And that's just not the case. In fact, you know, the government is really only responsible for the .gov/.mil domains. It's not responsible for the .com domain. And what happens now is sometimes, if you're lucky, the FBI comes across your data in the course of some investigation. And if they do that, they might make you a courtesy call, which is, I think, what they did with the DNC hack. They tried to make a courtesy call, and somehow it never actually reached the guy at the DNC. And next thing you knew, John Podesta's emails are being leaked all over WikiLeaks. So the government right now doesn't have a responsibility. It's almost like they're doing it, if they have time, out of the kindness of their own heart, you know. And that's strange, because at the same time, we're asking companies to fortify their systems from Russia, or in the case of Sony, from North Korean hackers who just destroyed 70,000 of their servers. So do I think the notification process could be better and we should have a standard notification process? Yes. But the problem is the government is now seeing, you know, at minimum thousands of attacks every single day. And if we ask them to notify thousands of companies a day, on a government budget, I just don't know if anything would get done. So it's a little unrealistic probably. But I think in cases where they see nation states targeting companies, particularly nation states that have made overt threats, and in this case, North Korea was making overt threats against Sony because this movie was coming out, which is, I still can't get over the fact that it was all over a James Franco. What was it? James Franco. Who's the other guy in it? The
Seth Rogen.
Seth Rogen movie. Yes. You know, in that case, I do think that the government was probably tracking what North Korea does. I mean, one of the things we learned from the Snowden documents is that the U.S. government in many cases will piggyback on some of hacks from other nation states. So we know that they piggybacked on hacks that South Korea has done, ostensibly in North Korea. The problem is the U.S. government doesn't want to admit that they're hacking our ally to hack our adversary. And they're very protective of their methods. And in some cases, attributing an attack means giving up their methods or giving up classified information. I don't really have an opinion on that, other than I think things have been overclassified at this point. And I think we saw that play out actually with the Sony attack. I mean, if you remember, It was the first time that a president of the United States has come out and said a country did this. Mm-hmm. And even when he did that, there was so much skepticism. How do you know?
Let's talk about that. Yeah. Because there was a lot of criticism about, first of all, just the attribution, but then also the evidence that they made public for why they were attributing.
Right.
It sets a precedent for other countries as well. If the evidence that you're providing for attribution doesn't really get you there to that attribution, but you are taking political steps, such as sanctions or something else, in response and retaliation, is there an obligation to, when you're attributing something like that you actually are going to respond to, should there be a higher bar for the evidence that you provide? And if not, doesn't that set a bad precedent for other countries to basically say, we're blaming this hack on the U.S. and we're not going to show you our evidence because it's classified and we don't have to?
Yeah, and we're not only blaming this hack on the U.S. in this analogy, we're actually planning to respond to the attack that we're accusing the U.S. of doing. So, yeah, in this case, the evidence that the U.S. government put out there in terms of how they knew North Korea was responsible for the Sony attack was minimal at best. And you had to take a leap of faith. The government was asking you to take a leap of faith that the evidence it had was solid enough that they were comfortable coming out and saying that this was North Korea. Granted, they'd never come out before and pointed a finger directly at a nation state like this before.
Well, let's say that the implication from the New York Times was that they were somehow in North Korean computers. So this was signals intelligence classified information. It wasn't a forensic investigation inside the computers, but they were somehow watching the conversations of North Korea in the computers, and that was how they knew.
Right. That was part of it. The other part was the private. There was evidence in the private sector, like the tools that were used in the Sony attack were some of the same tools used in attack on South Korean banks and broadcasters a year earlier. But even that is sort of fuzzy. You know, anyone could have grabbed those tools and used them for an attack. So the U.S. government was combining that with, signals intelligence, you know, conversations it was picking up in North Korea, and also some of its own intelligence coming out of its own hacks. And that's a method that it doesn't want to give up. So the evidence it put out there for saying this is North Korea was actually pretty paltry, and especially paltry in the security community's opinion, which likes to see everything, every T crossed and I dotted. So it was definitely an interesting an interesting attribution call. But I think what made it more interesting is that we didn't just say it was North Korea. We said we will respond in an appropriate manner. So they were sort of hinting that we have no idea what they did actually.
Right. You may know when we're responding and you may not know when we're responding.
Exactly. I mean, there was one day where it was lights out in North Korea, and I don't know if it was the U.S. government or someone, you know, turning off the wrong button. But, you know, we still don't know what that response was. We just only know it happened. So.
Well, so one of the responses that we have seen are indictments of nation-state actors, or presumably people who have been supported in some way by nation-states. So we saw indictments of Chinese military officers. We saw indictments of some people in Iran who supposedly launched denial-of-service attacks against U.S. banks and hacked into a control system at a dam in New York. And then we've seen indictments of people allegedly involved in some way in the DNC and election hacking. So the question is, what purpose do these indictments really serve? I mean, you're never going to drag a Chinese military officer into a court in California and prosecute them for this. What is the purpose of these very public indictments, and do they serve in any way as a deterrent?
So I think they're largely symbolic. I think that the U.S. government feels increasing pressure to do something. And you're right that China's never going to turn over their military center, send him on a plane to the U.S. because the U.S. indicted him. So it's largely symbolic. But, you know, at the same time, it sends a message that they know that they're tracking and they know who's done it. And that person can't travel beyond certain borders anymore. So there is sort of a liability there. But, you know, it's we're still figuring out our response. You know, what's interesting is the U.S. government has some of the most advanced cyber weapons and hacking capabilities in the world. We're also one of the most vulnerable because so much of our systems and critical systems is online. We have some of the most vibrant intellectual property, which is a target for hackers, particularly in China. So we have to do something. We have to create some deterrent. You know, what's interesting actually is that that indictment, it actually did have an effect to some extent, at least with the PLA hackers, which was that the Chinese government and the U.S. government, I think maybe several months later, came to an agreement that there would be no more tolerance for hacking of commercial trade secrets. And if there was going to be hacking of commercial trade secrets, that there would be sanctions or repercussions because of it. And if you believe some of the security reports out there, the hacking activity of trade secrets from China has gone down significantly. So that wasn't just the indictments. I think it was more the threat of sanctions and just the naming and shaming. But it did possibly have a beneficial effect. So it's not for nothing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, I think the U.S. government's definitely struggling with how to respond to some of these attacks. And, you know, they're not responding to them traditionally with cyber methods. They're responding to them with diplomatic methods. And I think in China, it's still sort of up in the air in terms of whether this was actually successful. But some of the initial data over the last couple of years shows that it did have some effect, however minimal. But I think Russia is a whole nother ballgame, and I don't think it's going to have any effect at all. And so it'll be interesting to see what this administration comes up with in terms of what an escalated response will be.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of Chinese hackers, journalists never really feel comfortable when they become part of the story. And you guys had a case in, I think it was 2013, where you wrote a story revealing that the New York Times had been hacked by Chinese nation-state hackers after one of your reporters had published a story on some information that China didn't want. And the hackers had obtained passwords of New York Times reporters, got into more than 50 systems, and siphoned some documents. So there's always some advantage when you go public with a hack like that, particularly you're letting other media companies know, you're warning them that you can be targeted by people who don't like what you've written. But there's also a risk, for example, in notifying potential anonymous sources that their identities may not be safe with you. So walk us through sort of the internal deliberations that happened at the New York Times in deciding why you guys ultimately went public with that.
So it was an interesting couple months. We found out that we were hacked, and I give the New York Times immense credit for letting me tell the story. And I was able to embed with our security team for a couple months and watch as the guy we called the Chinese summer intern rolled into our systems, you know, at 8 a.m. Beijing time, and rolled out at 5 p.m. Beijing time, and broke for lunch. And we weren't sure whether we were going to publish the story, but I was sort of in on this part of the process. And we'd called in a security firm that's now well known called Mandiant. And we weren't sure at first what they were after. We were worried that maybe they were hoping to do something to our printing systems, or maybe take our website down ahead of, I think there was an election coming up. I'm actually blanking on it right now. But we were worried they were going to do something disruptive. And then it became very clear, based on the computers that they were targeting, that they were after one of my colleagues who was working in China at the time, David Barbosa's emails. And specifically, they were after who his sources had been for one of the stories he had done about the Chinese leadership's family and corruption. What was interesting, though, about that story is that it wasn't actually based on any anonymous sources at all. It was based on hard work and laboring through some pretty obscure Chinese public documents. So once we found out what they were after, some of the fears about going public and scaring all of our anonymous sources into never giving the New York Times any information again dissipated a little bit just because of this particular situation. So in that respect, we were almost lucky that that didn't end up being a huge consideration for our decision to go public. That said, we did have a funny situation where after I did publish the story about the New York Times being hacked by China, I went to headquarters and one of my colleagues said, "Nicole, until your story came out, I didn't know why I came to work one day and my computer was missing. And they told me there was a note saying the FBI has your computer." So they on their way to get to David's email, they did make a few stops along the way. So it's not as if they just went straight for David's email. So it did come up in some conversations. The biggest consideration actually was towards the end when I had the story ready to go and they said, "Wait a second, should we really be doing this?" And this was back in 2013 where no company wanted to admit that it had been hacked. You know, if you admitted you were hacked, you were worried about what might happen to your share price, or you were worried that there was just going to be this big scarlet letter on your head, or that people wouldn't entrust you with their personal information. And so there was this big discussion towards maybe the weeks leading up to publication. You know, what will our competitors say? What will the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post say? And my take on that was they won't say anything because they've probably been hacked too. And lo and behold, we ended up publishing the story. And within an hour, you know, you saw Rupert Murdoch and people at the Washington Post say, "Us too," you know. And so it was sort of interesting to see that play out.
We're running out of time, but I want to follow up with that. What has the New York Times done in response to that in terms of internally improving its security, changing things? What happened as a result of that?
Well, we brought in a team of people who are just dedicated to helping the New York Times reporters secure their systems, which is a huge step. I mean, when I started, I could not believe the amount of information people just put out there on email and plain text. So now most of the information that we'll use with sensitive sources, we use apps like Signal or Wickr, which encrypts your communications. I think that there's just been a lot more awareness among New York Times reporters that they are targets and they have to treat their notes and their communications with a little bit more security in mind. And then, you know, we've just ramped up our security. We brought in a new team of the guy who leads our security at the New York Times, Drew Robbie, is actually a hacker himself. And, you know, we brought in people who really know what they're doing, and they know that every day you're a little bit at war. You know, you're seeing serious threats coming across your system. And it actually wasn't just China that hacked the New York Times. A Syrian group called the Syrian Electronic Army tried to take down our systems somewhat successfully for a small amount of time one day. And these are the threats that we're now up against. Mm-hmm. I think that now that there's this awareness that we're up against them, we're actually starting to see people take serious precautions, which is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. And we've also seen that spill out to other newsrooms now, because other newsrooms are, again, hiring security teams, in which never existed before, really, at all.
No, it's great.
Okay, well, I think that we are running out of time now. I want to thank Nicole on behalf of the World Affairs for joining us, and I want to thank everyone in the audience as well for arriving tonight and for your participation with questions. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Nicole Perlroth. She's a reporter at the New York Times. She was in conversation with Kim Zetter, author of Countdown to Zero Day. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Jane Heaven. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.